Welcome to the Movies on the Brain podcast, episode number 302. I am one of your podcast hosts, Brian C. Wood, and with me this evening is my good friend and co-host,
Chad Mintz.
Welcome to another weird, wild, and wacky week in the world of Jolly Holly movie news. So, Chad, we have seen the Blue People. After many years of wandering in the wilderness, wondering whether or not this thing was actually going to be a thing, it is indeed a thing. We'll start our reactions with the box office, which seems to be a massive disappointment to a lot of people, which should not be the case, and we'll get into that in a while. But your thoughts on the $135 million debut?
So at first blush, in the current state of movies, you would look at that and everything we know about Avatar. It kind of has to start with how much people think this movie actually costs. And it's weird to figure out this movie because apparently he shot this one with the next one and how they hash out those budgets. But it's somewhere north of like $400 million. And when you add in marketing and all that, this movie has to make over $1 billion to break even, which is insanity. No matter what you think about any movie outside, like the only one I could even justify that for in recent memory is Endgame, but that's a culmination of 10 years that you know you've built up to this one point. Avatar has been 13 years and you're asking it to make $1 billion to break even, which seems insane. So when you get a box office that's honestly, for it to hit the expectations people have, you would think it's going to have to go over $200 million the first weekend. So I get why people are saying it's a disappointment. However, the thing with the first Avatar that people are comparing this to this Avatar is it's going to have it. How do the legs do? If it has the legs, it should make the money. And I get that. I agree. If this thing has legs, this opening is not going to be as bad as it looks. Top Gun opened at like 126 and made over $1 billion by the end of it. The difference to me is that while, yes, this thing is, there's nothing coming out between now and Ant-Man in the middle of February. So it has like two whole months to just run free. But what made the first Avatar the money-making behemoth that it was that it continuously ran and performed well for like a year. And I don't know if the landscape we have right now is conducive for that. So I think this thing is going to make money. I don't know how much money, but I know what we're thinking the break-even money is going to be. That might be the top end of what it makes. And then it's going to be, is that good enough for what this is? So when you talk about the box office for Avatar, I think it's a wait and see. It'll make money the first weekend. It's going to make money next weekend because that's the holiday weekend. What's it going to look like in a month? That's really where the rubber meets the road with them.
Yeah, I mean, like, so here's my thing. Legs in a run were always the way that this thing was going to go. We saw Top Gun Maverick run through summer and fall with all kinds of competition, kept making money, kept staying in the top three to the top five, working its way out and then working its way back in. And that's the kind of pathway that this film is going to have to take. What benefited the original film was word of mouth and just this massive publicity campaign of, as you said on Twitter this morning, you know, you have to see this in a theater. And because you have to see it in a theater and because it's 3 hours long, there's less opportunities for you to show it across less screens. And that's kind of an aggravating factor for people who are deciding whether or not they want to put themselves through this.
Yeah.
I think that word of mouth will be key. Repeat viewings will be key. Competition won't be as much of a factor. Weather will be a factor as far as like cold snaps and feet of snow across the Midwest and set in Northeast. Available screens will be an issue. But ultimately, I don't think Disney cares, because I think that we are talking in terms of tangible box office numbers, whereas they're thinking globally in terms of the movie is doubling what it's doing domestically overseas. It's doing what it's doing without the China numbers right now. They have a theme park attachment to it. This will drive more people to the theme park because they will be more aware of what Avatar is now. They will probably redesign a new ride around the Way of Water. So that will be an attraction that will draw people. And then there's the merchandise. They move. You have been to Avatar Land, Chad. It has brought more people to Animal Kingdom than ever went to Animal Kingdom before. You exit through the gift shop for a reason, sir.
I'm laughing because I went when Animal Kingdom first opened that year. We went to Animal Kingdom.
1998.
One of them. We went, I remember going to that damn tree, and I remember hating that place. And every time I went after that, I explicitly skipped Animal Kingdom because I'm like, I don't want to go to the zoo. And then the last time we went, we went to Animal Kingdom, and we went to Pandora Land, and the whole setup is impressive. I didn't get to ride the really big ride there, but like my dad got on it, and he was like, he doesn't care about any of these rides. And the only two rides he said anything about the whole time we were there was Rise of the Resistance and this ride. So if it made an impression on him to even say anything, that speaks to what these rides are. So for Disney, the movie coming out, no matter how much it makes, yeah, it feeds into that theme park. It keeps that theme, that part of the theme park alive. Yeah, they can put some more rides in there. They can add parts to the ride that they already have with the water stuff. It's worth it for them in that aspect. It's just going to be like the actual box office part of it.
And I don't know how much of a bath they're going to take. I don't think they're going to be in Warner Brothers Discovery territory and be, you know, taking write-offs anytime soon on this project. But I think that he's done enough and will do enough by the end. Let's just say Valentine's weekend. Between now and Valentine's weekend, I think he'll do enough to justify 3. And then I think 3 will probably do something similar to what 2 has done, if not more. And then we'll go from there, you know. But I think the fact that there are less years in between, there's 2 years between films now. I think people have an emotional attachment to some of these characters now that they did not the first go around. I think both those things will help. I think both those things will help the film tremendously box office wise. And like I said, people have been clamoring and in circling the box office buzzards about this film since Thursday, where it had when they got the preview numbers. This is a long game. This is not just a theatrical game for Disney. And I think that you have to take all of that into account when you figure out what they're going to do. Because remember, check's already written for 3. So Disney really can't make a judgment call on this thing until after 3. And Cameron has said that he's willing to cut it off after 3 if the audience isn't interested. So we'll see.
Well, the thing with that is, we have to remember that Disney didn't finance these. This was all
Fox. Yeah, like I said, Fox cut the check. Rupert Murdoch cut the check for 2 and 3 to be filmed together.
Exactly. So he's already, per my understanding, if this changed every time I read anything, but he's filmed as much as 1 and 2 all the way through. And I've also heard that he's filmed those two. I mean, not 1 and 2. I mean, 2 and 3. But I've also heard that he's filmed part of 4.
Okay, so the clarification on that from the producer on the film, one of the producers on the film, is that one, that two is completely shot and done in theaters. Three is 98% done. They have to go back for a few little reshoots. They have filmed the opening sequence of four. That's all they've shot. They haven't shot anything other than the first 10 minutes of four. I think four is the one where somebody said that a producer in Hollywood read the script and they said it was effing nuts. How you get effing nuts in an Avatar movie, I have no idea. I mean, considering this man blended Free Willy, Whale Rider, and Titanic into one movie, I don't know how you get nuts, more nuts.
Well, four is the one that he keeps talking about is like, it's like the one. He can get to four. Four is the one. But I'm glad you had that clarification. So three is coming out no matter what.
Three is bought and paid for and shot.
Right.
There is, no call Disney can make on three. Three is coming out in 2024 regardless.
Right. And I think having filmed the beginning of four is like his like security blanket to be like, look, we've already spent money on this a little bit. Come on, give me the rest. But yeah, I think the returns on two and three together will tell the tale about if we get anything beyond that.
Which is how it should be, because like that's been my problem with this narrative we've been fighting through all weekend, is you're making it at the beat writers and the box office observers and everybody has been making it out like this is a judgment call that has to be made this morning, the Monday morning after release, that Disney had to decide whether or not to greenlight another Avatar movie. It's not like they had to greenlight it. It's already been made. It has already been paid for. We are getting it regardless. So, like, December 21st, 2024, when three is actually in theaters, then we can have the discussion about whether or not this was a justifiable thing and they can go ahead with making four. But right now, we can't have that discussion, I don't think. And so blowing preview numbers and first weekend numbers and first Monday numbers and comparing them with the Batman and comparing them with Top Gun and comparing them with Wakanda Forever and Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness ain't going to do any good. All that's going to do is where it's going to finish in the list of the highest grossing domestic box office movies of 2022. And at the end of the day, if you went and asked even the most ardent Hollywood reporter, journalist, or box office observer, and you asked them to name the top five films from last year, box office wise, they would struggle. No one remembers the top five box office year to year. They remember the all timers and the ones that finish in the top. So where it finishes in 2022 is inconsequential to me. It's what we get with two and three combined and what that means for Disney.
So, with all the prognostication over the weekend, I think a lot of people just failed to realize how far they go. Like, they didn't realize that three was a package deal and was like almost done. I know I didn't realize it most of the weekend, but I wasn't like talking about it either. So some people might want to actually like look into things. But yeah, the story of, I don't want to say like the returns on two don't matter. They do. But again, it's very much if two is, let's say two has disappointing returns, but then three comes out and exceeds what two does, I think you're fine. I think two is only judged that in terms of getting more sequels in its relation to the returns on three. And not on the relations
It's what the first half of the story is determines how much is riding on the second part of the story, you know. And I get that. I also think it's in large part to this Christmas season or this holiday season being vacant in a way that most holiday seasons aren't. This, I would argue, is our first real post-COVID Christmas time at the theater, and I think that the reason Way of Water has eyes on it is because outside of Violent Night, there's nothing else making money at the box office right now. I mean, if you look at the box office results from the weekend, it's Avatar at, what, 134, 135, and then everything else makes five or three or four million all the way rest of the way down. Like, nothing, it's the big thing. And so it's catching everybody's attention and everybody's focusing and hyper-vigilant of it. Whereas if it was one of four blockbusters that were coming out this month, it would be a different story. But because it's the end of the year, because the first movie was so successful, it's got more eyeballs on it than it really should, considering the narrative that's been going around all weekend.
I think, yeah. I mean, I think that might cover it for the money part. That I'm just kind of waiting to see.
Put it this way. Disney and James Cameron aren't going to jump into a pit of piranhas and, you know, and kill themselves over this box office this weekend.
Right.
They will gladly take this box office as a win and keep it going.
Right.
And at the end of the day, that's all that matters. So let's talk about free. Let's talk about whale. Wait, no, that's not it. Let's talk about Titanic. No. Let's talk about Avatar, The Way of Water. And let's start with our, you know how we always do these things? For those, the uninitiated, the new, Chad and I go over our good, our bad, and our not so good for a particular film. We don't always go in order. I torture Chad that way. And so let's start with our good. What is the good for you from this film, Chad? And I'll modify it. No visuals. Visuals cannot count toward the good, the bad, or the not so good.
Since podcast
can't take the cop out answer, sir.
Since podcasting is a visual medium, I'm saying that funny. Yes, Brian said that, and as soon as he says, I fling my arms up because I'm like, what else do you want me to say? Like, you took away what I was going to say for the good. It's the easiest good in the world. The thing is pretty. It is visually appealing to look at through the whole thing. I don't know. But you took that away. So I guess I'll say the good is, I think, compared to the first one, this one had more compelling characters, or at least characters I cared about just a little bit to get me through the story. Because the first one did not. Everything I remember about the first Avatar, granted, I've only seen it once, but everything I remember about Avatar comes from the Robot Chicken sketch, Blue Rabbits. I've mentioned it before. If y'all don't know what it is, Google Robot Chicken, Blue Rabbits. You are welcome. But that's been a knock on the first Avatar. It's like, who remembers anything? Can you name a character from Avatar? I always knew Jake Sully. And really, again, it's because of that skit. This one, while I have a problem with names, full disclosure, I missed the first 5 minutes of this movie because, you know, we were late. I was like, trailers will still be running when we walk in. No. We walked in. They were in the middle of date nights. I have no idea what happened before he said the word date night.
They were in the middle of what?
Date night.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what happened before he said those words, because that's when we walked in the theater. But I at least cared about the kids. Jake was fine. Zoe, again, I don't know her. I try to know names in movies. I can't even remember her name, and I just saw the damn thing. Natiri, okay. She disappears for like half of the movie. We can get into that later. But I basically know most of the kids' names. It was hard to distinguish the two sons at first, but I kind of got it down.
It's a lot easier now, Chad. A lot easier.
Now it is. The daughters I had no problem with, especially because I knew one of them was a Sigourney Weaver. Going in, I knew she was Sigourney Weaver. So it was like, okay, I know you. But I thought, like, so I thought they kept calling her Kitty, the whole name. I know her name is Kiri. But the whole time, it just sounds like they kept saying Kitty. So I know who she is. But
are you having a cat flashback, sir?
No. It's I take it they introduced all of them at the very beginning. What I missed.
They went through the births of all the kids and explained where they came from up before date night.
See, that would have been useful information to me. But every time they kept saying her name, and it was the little girl that said her name the most, it just sounded like Kitty. Like Kiri sounded like Kitty for some reason to me. But that's where it was. But, you know, overall, I cared about the characters enough to not fall asleep. Well, the visual kept me from not falling asleep. But I cared about them just enough for me to only check my watch like 3 times through the whole thing.
All right. So my good is going to be the humor. This is a funny movie. And not in the like slapstick comedy route, but like there's way more laughing moments in this film than the first one. It looks like they took an aim toward pumping up the sarcasm and the biting wit of this movie, which I appreciated very much. I love the idea of a renegade white boy just flipping people off and telling authority where to go. But like the humor of it, the jokes for me land, and they help with the depth and the brevity of the film. I would also classify the performances and the characters as a good. The part that you missed was basically just them going over the kids and how they were conceived or born, and I see why Cameron talked about Godfather, because this is family. This is about family, and oddly enough, you get Michael and Fredo and Sonny. You get the kid who feels like he's not smart enough, he's not good enough, and Daddy hates him. And you get the appointed son who everybody assumes is going to run things. So you get Sonny and Michael in a little bit of Fredo all in one in both of those boys. And that's funny to me that Cameron pulled that dynamic off after, again, repeatedly referring to the Godfather trilogy. I also love that he borrowed from Dawn of Justice in the sense that this is a movie that begins with one thing and ends with the same kind of thing. The movie begins with the birth of the son, and then the movie ends with the burial of the son. So I love that that poetic licensing there. But the kids, the performances, there are narrative choices that I don't necessarily like, in story wise, but also character wise. For example, I feel they made the relationship between Jake and Neytiri much more chauvinistic than I really would like. Old homeboy says, okay, we're packing up and we're moving from everything that we've known for the entirety of our time together and that you've known all of your life. And I'm going to forfeit the throne and we're going to go away. And here's Neytiri not really having a conversation. Just being like, okay. And then getting on the little flying creatures and flying away, looking back, crying the entire time. And it's like, that feels like a conversation that needs to be more than like 2 minutes on screen. And she's such a strong and powerful character that, you know, Cameron's written very well. So I don't understand why you don't have her have objections to this idea of moot. Because really, basically it comes down to Neytiri saying, we got to go kill this man to protect our family and kill the demon to protect our family. And he's like, no, we run. And she's like, but Jake. And he's like, no, we run. And she's like, okay, we run. And it's like, that just doesn't really seem like Neytiri's way of thinking. Like, I feel like she would have put up more of a fight for her people and for her family in her place. Because she has to leave her mom. She has to leave the relatives that she has left in the Sky Mountains to go and do this. So, but the performances, especially the performances from the two boys, really hammer really were, am I good?
Okay, I can dig that. I know we'll talk about some of the other stuff in a few seconds.
All right, so let's talk about our not so good, Chad. What is your not so good from Avatar: The Way of Water?
Why in the hell is this movie over 3 hours long? Why? Why? Like, I...
The third act, that's why.
But, okay, the third... I think if you ask anybody that saw this movie, people be like, I really love the third act. That's where all the action happens. Now, granted, it's like a long third act because it's an hour and there's a bunch of false finishes in that third act. You can probably got rid of some of those. I don't want to call it filler, but there's a lot of stuff in there. Like, you could have made this movie like at most a 2 hour movie. And I think people would have enjoyed it more. And business talking, you can get more people in the seats because you don't have this 3 hour behemoth to deal with. Like the theater I saw this in, there are only 3 IMAX screenings a day because they're all theaters are only starting at like noon now, but it takes like a 4 hour chunk of your day. So you can only show it 3 times. You cut that down to a 2 hour movie, you get more butts and seats. But like, understand that once you take advantage and show us all this of the water people stuff, but you can either make that movie, like world build in that movie, or you can make the He's Out for Revenge movie with some of the world building sprinkled in. You don't make two big behemoths of the same thing, of those two things, and put it together and make it this 3 hour movie when it didn't have to be. You could have made some different choices. Like, dang it, you said something a minute ago about how he used time. It was like, oh, the conversation that they should have had. He kept that short, but then expand, like, just runs wild. Like, a lot of the stuff to fill out this time really is him saying, look at all the pretty stuff I made. I want you to look at all of it for like 15 minutes when I can just do this in maybe like 2 and we could have moved on. It's just the fact that this movie's over 3 hours. It's really inexcusable to me.
So I felt I didn't really feel the runtime, mainly because I had alcohol in my system. But the thing for me was like, how do I say this? Like, there's always fluff that you can cut. There's always darlings you can kill when you're in the editing room. And I think that there could have been some better choices in the editing room than what we got. That I didn't feel the length till we got to all the false finishes in the third act. And the thing is, Chad, me and you are both, as we talked about on the last episode, we're wrestling nerds. Like, you have to have an emotional built-in connection. Like, 5 false finishes in Taker versus Michaels at WrestleMania 25, where you were in the building, works because they build to each one of those finishers and you buy in and you believe that this could be the end of the streak with every time Michaels goes, and you buy into everything because the psychology and the storytelling that those two greats are putting on, you know, sucks you in and makes you believe. Not every one of those false finishes in that third act work that way, where it's like, I can actually buy that this is the end for Jake Sully. I can actually buy that he's going to like bite the dust here and that the bad guy is going to win. Like, not all those false finishes work because I'm not always invested in them. My biggest issue with time and filler and that kind of a thing is why it takes so damn long for, you know, the colonel and the forces and the troops to go find him. And the way that they end up finding him is very accidental. It's not even like the result of hard work. It's the result of kids being stupid, which they do a lot in this film. But like, you didn't need to keep them in the water village that long before the colonel shows up. And like, you don't need all of the building of the trust between the outsiders and the insiders of the water tribe Like, you can earn their respect and do that in a quicker way. The other thing, too, is we don't keep needing visual funerals. Like, you don't need these exacerbated long shot selections of bursts. You don't need these long shot selections of funerals for whales. You don't need some of these elongated celebration sequences. You can cut down on some of that, and it will actually help the runtime. This movie's 2 hours and 20 minutes, just like the original was. No problem. I think we have a lot better film. But it's Cameron. No one's going to tell him, hey, bro, you need to kill your darlings here.
Yeah, and like, as we talk, there's more things that come up that could have just been, you know, you could have just chopped some of this off. But I'm not going to belabor that point. I think time was an issue. And it really just felt like he wanted to show off. I have this time to show off. I'm going to show off now.
Well, especially the underwater stuff, right. which is going to be my not so good. And it's not the underwater stuff as a whole. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. It's awesome. It's amazing. But for me, the underwater stuff, is cool and awesome and amazing. But explain to me this. Old homegirl hooks herself up to the tree of life that's underwater. You know, they talked about these upload and download spots that are across the moon of Pandora that connect them to Watiri and the into the life form. Basically their connection to the Force, if you want to use a Star Wars term. She hooks herself up into that. She has a seizure and quote unquote nearly dies. However, she hooks herself up to multiple things across the rest of the film, including something to help, you know, end the gigantic battle. No need to go into a seizure. Just can happen. Just can work. And I'm like, okay, so either she pulled a Jean Grey and overshot herself and burned herself out, or it was her first time using that power, and so now she has a big, better ability to use it. But if you're going to say that, if you tell me the next time said character does this, they're going to die, and then the character does it not once, not twice, but three times after that, and they don't die, then you have completely made your point irrelevant. You had no reason to do the seizure scene earlier in the film. It doesn't make sense. It's not good storytelling.
I've been, again, y'all, since y'all can't see me, I've been like in agreement with Brian in this little corner of my screen, just fiercely shaking my head. Yes, yes. So I'm gonna bring that up. There's a couple of things that they bring up in this film that there's no payoff for. And I'm going to assume, just like what the thing with her seizures, is that is going to pay off in the next film. But I don't think you should, particularly with that one, because it's so jarring. Like, that whole scene with her getting the seizure comes out of nowhere. You could, if it's something that's going to pay off in the next movie, do it in the next movie. You don't have to do it now. Because we've seen her, up to that point, we saw her get with everything. Like, she was of all the kids, she took to the water the quickest and was just in tune with it. So you could have just had, like, the stuff she does at the end. She could have done that, and I don't think anybody would have questioned it.
Especially the way that they set her up, because they are essentially setting her up to be Anakin Skywalker. You remember that comment? I know the Phantom Menace was a long, long time ago, Chad, but do you remember that conversation that Qui-Gon has with Anakin's mother? And Anakin and Qui-Gon ask about the father, and she's like, there was no father. I just kind of woke up one day and all of a sudden I was pregnant. And they can't really explain it. And then he has this high midichlorian count, and you know the rest of the story. And right. You know, there are some interpretations of that that say that Palpatine formed him in the womb. There are some interpretations of that that say that, you know, the Force itself created Anakin within the womb. But like, it's an Immaculate Conception story is basically the story of Anakin Skywalker. They are making her out to be the child of a Immaculate Conception, because randomly one day this is the part you didn't see because you it's in that first little burst segment, that Sigourney Weaver's avatar from the first movie, they kept it. And all of a sudden, one day, it just has a baby inside of it. And it grows and it bursts the child. Which I have questions about how an unanimated corpse bursts a baby. But then, but that's what happens. They can't explain where she came from. They can't explain who her father is. They make jokes about who her father is throughout the movie.
So those,
like, yeah. They are very clearly pointing to she is the physical embodiment of like the Mother Earth. She is the physical embodiment of the Force that everybody taps into. She is Arwa or whatever they call it. And so they're going that way, which is fine, but they don't need to do the stroke stuff and the seizure stuff, you know, for any reason whatsoever to further that point.
Yeah, like I'm glad you said that because that makes a lot more sense. And to note, you are the second person I've heard today to make that point that it's probably Immaculate Conception. And hearing that, it does, like the things they were saying around her having the seizure, like, you know, it sounds like she has epilepsy and everything she's describing that sounds spiritual to them also can be described as being epileptic. And I think that's where they're going. They want to give you the doubt. And then she turns out to be divine in that way. But none of that had to happen in this movie. You could have done that in the next movie and then pay it off in the next movie.
You've already proven her connection to the Arwa. You've already proven her. Like, she's literally lying on the ground listening to the heartbeat. She has a whole conversation with her dad where she talks about the fact that she can hear Arwa's heartbeat and it is mighty. Like, you've established this girl has a connection with Awa. So, like, you don't need to do the whole seizure, is it holiness thing to get to the payoff at the end where she hooks herself up and saves everybody.
Yeah, so I would, that was one of the things I was going to point out as, like, an unnecessary, like, plot point you left there to be paid off in another movie. I was going to bring up the dad thing, but with everything you just said, I get what they're doing there. It's still kind of the same thing, but I get it. The stuff. Oh, the one of the false finishes when Nadiri, you know, puts the knight to the human boy. It was like, you know, son for a son kind of thing. Like, that happens, and then no mention of it after that happens. Like, him and her in the same scene and nobody's talking about it. And it's like, this is a pretty big thing that just happened. It seems like.
Yeah. My deal with that, Chad, was like, okay, based on the context and the way that this scene is set up and the way that you've demonstrated everything, it seems as though it was a pre-communicated thing between the two of them to try and draw Colonel to do what they need him to do. Because I can't come to any other conclusion, because if old girl pulls a knife on you, holds it to your neck, slices your chest open, you are 98% less more likely to walk away and go help the bad guy after the good guy does that to you. You're not going to tell the bad guy, here, I'm going to go pull you from the wreckage because these good people have taught me to help other people. But I'm not, you know, it's the Batman Forever, the Batman Begins line. I don't have to kill you, but I you know, I don't have to rescue you either. He rescues him and leaves him there, and whatever happens with him happens. But then he walks away and goes right back to his family. So, like, the only context I can put on that, the only reason logically that he would go back to them is if it were a pre-planned thing. Which, again, we don't get any scenes with them together before that. We don't have any explicit moment where they would have been able to connect in that way and talk about that particular plan. But that's the only inference I can draw, because he would have left and gone and sided with the humans, especially after getting his chest cut.
Yeah, I don't think it was a pre-planned thing, just because once he pulls him out and the boy, like, extends the olive branch to him, like, you saved me, like, yeah. You can come with me. He does like they do, shows his teeth and runs. So I think it was just a
he does the whole he's not even on the same race thing.
Right. I think he has seeing her be like that awakened something in him, but he did bond with him somewhat, but he also saw how mean and cruel and violent he was. So he went back to what he already knew. But I mean, there's no way that kid isn't changed. And it's like, that is something that they could have held off, like paying off until the next movie. But you can't just, I don't think you should just leave it as she cut him open and now everything is hunky dory. Like, you gotta, like, just something as small as him having an uneasy glance at her afterwards. Like, okay, I get it. Okay, I see what you're doing. We're gonna get something, but we're not there yet. Cool, I'm with that. But yeah, that,
because you play it off as he has a choice and he chooses to go back to the family.
Right.
That's the way you play it off. And it's like, that doesn't logically make storytelling sense if this man just had his chest exposed, just had his chest exposed.
Yeah, that really frustrated me, because it's like, you, it's so hard to come, it just seems like it would be so hard to come back from that. But again, just a little something, and I'm like, okay, I know we got another movie coming. We're at the end of this movie. This is something to look forward to. This is not an unnecessary plot point. It's something that happened that you can build and develop in another movie. It just seems like, again, he wants to do so much that, like, shoring up some of these writing things was not a priority.
So, like, for me, the unnecessary thing for me was, why didn't Tyrion wait until, like, her son dies to go ape shit on people and just start messing them up? Because, like, she really doesn't do all the bloodthirsty, like, shooting the arrows and straight up murking people the way she's capable of until after that happens. So it's like, you've been doing this, like, 20 minutes before?
The side, they clearly made a choice that they wanted to put her on the side. They have so many new characters, and they wanted to focus on, you know, Scully is the one that the new Avatar people want. So he's the hero. You have to have a certain amount of focus on him, but you're bringing in all these new characters with all this new part of the world. So they chose to put the Dairy on the side. But as the end of the movie shows you, she is the most capable of all the people we've shown. So it doesn't make sense for her to be on the side, except that you just want to do these other things. And I think that's a disservice to that character and to what has come before, because she, unlike Scully, she grew up Na'vi and she is truly native and a part of that world that more so than anybody else we spent time with of the new, like, with the kids and stuff. But because we want to do all this other stuff, she gets sidelined. And then when she comes at the end, it's like, okay, now we're reminded of what she was.
Yeah, it was kind of a surprise to me that they went that direction. Again, it just really, really, really frustrated me that she didn't put up more of a fight with him about leaving. Because, like, ultimately, the story of this film is you can't run from your past. You can't run from your sins. They will eventually catch up to you, and you will be one day forced to atone for them. And, you know, what was he going to do? Okay, they showed up at the Water Tribe. He didn't immediately leave the Water Tribe to go over the Sky Mountains. He went to the Water Tribe, and he was like, I mean, they killed your sacred whale, so if you'd like to help me, please do. But I'm prepared to leave if you need me to. It wasn't an immediate, like, okay, these guys are here now, the Lord protects you and your people who are now dying because we're being tortured and losing their homes. We're going to move on to the next biome. Have a nice day. No, it was very much like, you know, they killed your whale, so maybe you want to help me now?
So, well, I'm glad we had this part, because that is part of my bad as well. But since we went deep in this one, I'll just mention my other bad, which I'm sure certain sects will get upset with me. But so the Na'vi are clearly being portrayed. I mean, we've made the jokes like this is any other colonization movie. The Na'vi are the natives, whether they be Native Americans or native to any other country. And everybody else, they're just, you know, colonizing white people. So with like in the first one, I'm pretty sure all of the actors for the actual Na'vi were people of color, almost specifically like black people. Because I'm thinking that, you know, Zoe is, she's Afro-Latina. Laz Alonso was in this movie. He's black. CCH Fonda is her mom, black. So when we get to the kids we have now and the water people, specifically one water person, he decided not to do that. Now, the Kiri makes sense, where she came from. Immaculate from Sigourney Weaver. That made sense. The rest of the kids, they're just white kids. Okay, you know, Sully's white, got you, whatever. I looked up all the water people. They look to be New Zealanders, the indigenous of New Zealand, or maybe Hispanic, some of them. I didn't remember quite the names, except for the I guess she would be the queen. She's the chief's wife. It's Door Girl. I cannot remember her real name. Kate Winslet. That's it. I have no problem with Kate Winslet, but I was sitting there, I'm knowing that it's her, and when they're doing the ritual over Kiri, and she's going through the whole process, I'm like, man, I feel mad uncomfortable knowing that this white woman is doing this when this is like she is basically portraying an indigenous person doing a ritual. I know they're aliens, they're blue people, whatever, but that's what they were going for. Everything else about it
is very much feels appropriation like.
Yeah. Everything else about it is of indigenous people that are not white. And she's doing this. I was like, I don't know how I feel about this. And then in sort of kind of that spirit, like when we, as we mentioned before, when Ndiri goes and like starts kicking everybody's ass, there is a point where somebody says she's gone savage. And again, when you're wrapped all of this into nativism and colonization and all this stuff, and that's what this movie's trying to say. When you say that, it invokes a certain thing. I know he can say it's for the art or whatnot, but it, again, mad uncomfortable knowing all the people behind this, and you're calling the one for sure black woman the savage when she's going out to protect her kids. So I ain't like none of that. Anything involved with that, I didn't like any part of that.
Yeah, it feels very cultural appropriation. She did a good job, as far as I'm concerned, of like the language and seeming like, you know, she fit in. And she very much, in contrast to the Sully Ndiri dynamic, she very much seems to be the spiritual and physical leader of that tribe. She's, even though she's a pregnant child woman, like, she very much seems to be the one who makes the decisions of the family, which is a contrast, and I like that. You know, I think that the effort was made in other places, but I also feel like he wanted someone to work with, someone that he had worked with before, who he trusted to carry out his vision for what that role is going to be and what it is. Because remember, the producers have all told us that everybody's read the scripts. Everybody's read the scripts. So everybody knows where the story's going, and they can help that, let that inform their performances going forward. I think you just want somebody who's comfortable with to work in such a key role that's going to be so important going forward. And she still has a kid to put out, by the way. And so I think that's the deal with that. My bad, Chad, is the Free Willy movie. The Free Willy and the Rail Rider movie. You know, it's been a while since I've seen Free Willy. It was nice to see him again. It was a really fun time. He made Free Willy. He made Free Willy. Outcast boy, friends whale, and then helps whale abandon freedom, get to freedom by taking him away from hunters who are using harpoons and guns. He made Free Willy without the like one mention, without Michael Jackson song and the scene of the whale jumping over the fence, the stone wall. However, he didn't jump over a ship, so basically the same.
I did not think about that while watching it. Listening to things afterwards, they did bring it up. I'm like, well, hot damn, he did. And part of the reason why is because I was just old enough where I thought Free Willy was stupid. So I hated that movie. And I've done a lot to forget that movie. But well, yeah.
It came out in what, 93 or 94. It's more up there.
So I mean, I'm going to tell you what year it came out. And I promise you, the other things that I was into, I should not have been above this movie. It came out in 93. So I was, let's see.
1992 is what I think. 92 or 93.
It came out July 16, 1993. So I was 11 when it came out. I can promise you, I should not have been above that movie. Everything else I was into, but I hated that movie.
Something about the Michael song didn't strike you well enough?
No, I actually forgot about that too, but since we started talking about it, it's been playing in my head nonstop. I didn't care about the song. The song was fine.
You're
I
just, welcome, Jack. Merry Christmas.
It's just the movie. I just didn't like the movie.
There's literally a shot of him riding the whale all happy and free, and it's like, this is Whale Rider. This is Free Willy. Like, this isn't like an accident. Like, the first movie has the exact same plot of Dance with Wolves. That's why I have referred to it for the last 13 years as Dance with Wolves with Blue People. You replace Kevin Costner with Jake Sully. So, I mean, that's about all I can say about that. And there I'm sitting here watching this damn movie, and I'm going through it, and they have this whole explanation of harpoons and trackers and the whales, and if we kill the whales, the natives will get pissed off. And I'm just going like, this is Free Willy. We made Free Willy. I cannot believe this. And when we talk about the length, and we talk about the breadth, and we talk about all that, leading up to old boy whale explaining the story about why he is an outcast could have taken a lot less time. Like, he didn't have to keep asking him in old well boy and just being like, no, not story time now. Story time later. Very sad. Like, you didn't need to keep putting him off that way. You could have eventually just had him tell the story and helped it inform the audience. By the way, Cameron is the absolute worst at making up fake names for things. And I say this because the rock that they were mining for in the first movie, do you remember what the rock and the mineral was called?
I do, because I remember it being ridiculous. It's unobtainium.
Yes. And the same is true for this gold liquid that they extract from the brains of the whales. It is some kind of silly, stupid, very childish thing that a third grader could have come up with. Obsidian or something. I don't remember what the exact term was, but like, yeah, it's like Cameron's not the best at naming his MacGuffins.
I think
it isn't even really a MacGuffin, because like, no one's really interested in harvesting the ship, except for old boy who gets his arm ripped off.
Yeah, I think when they said the name of it, because this is a 3-hour movie and I'm an old man, I went to the bathroom and I missed something. So I think that was it, because I didn't remember that they said they were harvesting that specifically, or that it had a name.
Yeah, because it stops the aging process, like literally stops it.
Yeah, that I can understand why it will be so valuable, because we as humans suck and would actually want that. So that was that's actually a point that's like, okay, I understand why you're going this.
But the other part of it too, Chad, is they make it explicit in the film that humans are no longer just using Pandora for a mining colony, that they are looking to rehome there. They make it explicit that they are trying to make Pandora inhabitable for humans to live there. One of the reasons why they won't take Sully down, because they believe that if they take Sully down, all the rest of the tribes will fold. That's just a more blatant thing than what they were in the first one, where it's just like, there's not really, you know, we killed all our green, but we're not worried about going to another green plant, we're just worried about getting this Unobtainium, because it's worth $30 million a kilo. So, our final thoughts on the Way of the Water, Avatar the Way of the Water. Your thoughts are on what the film, do you want to continue to play in this world? Are you more interested after this film? And what biome would you like to see them explore next? Because it's very clear their new home base will be the water people, but they will also explore other biomes.
I came into this thing feeling like I just wasn't going to care at all about this. It actually felt like a chore going to see the movie. And my daughter kind of felt the same way. It was like, we're going to go see it, but do we really want to go? I mean, she honestly had planned on taking a nap during the movie. So she came out of the movie not taking a nap. So she was at least interested and entertained for that much. I only checked my watch like 3 times. So, and like I said, I was interested in the characters enough to continue looking at the pretty picture. So I think, you know, it's a decent movie. It's a good movie, like movie going experience. So I think it succeeded in that point. I think by design and by just the visual nature of the movie, I do want to see more, but I want to see more and not a... I need him to lose some of the self-flating things he did in this movie to make it so goddamn long. Make it a tighter, visually appealing action, sci-fi action movie, and I think they're in business. As for where they go next, I don't care. He seems to be creative enough to come up with these locations that are visually appealing, and I know he likes to do things different. So in that aspect, I'll trust him to go wherever he wants, as long as he can fix some of the other problems.
So I'm interested to see where this goes, because you set up a couple of different things. One, if you're equating this to The Godfather, then the kid who was Fredo is now the only son. They killed the son who was good at everything, and now we've just been left with this other kid who's kind of awkward and tossed away else. So I'm interested to see where that goes and how his character develops. He very clearly has a relationship with one of the water women, females, which I think is going to be interesting to see where that goes as well. I'm interested to see how Jake and Melissa and the Tyrese life and relationship changes after losing a child, because I think that should be something that is addressed and not just passed over. I'm interested to see how the Colonel's clone reacts to being rejected by the Tarzan kid, Spike. I'm interested to see how he reacts to that. As far as like biomes, you know, we did the ship sinking and the water and the almost drowning this time, and we've done the mountains and we've done the forest. So I would assume that we're going up to the sky based tribe, to the people of the air, but we'll see. it's just going to be interesting because we know that, that, as the Colonel said, as long as I'm alive, the clone, as long as I'm alive, as long as I'm breathing, this ain't over. And that's when Sully goes, okay, so we end this now. Which he didn't end it because, Spider saved it. I'm interested to see where and how he pushes him next and how much time elapses between films as far as, time on the planet. I'm interested in how they're going to do the Immaculate Conception story and what role she is going to play in the ending of this story, however it plays out. Because the thing is, if you go back and you watch the first movie, Jake essentially prays to Awa, hey, look into my soul, look into Grace's memories, see how messed up Earth people are. You don't want them coming here, please help us. And then Sherry's just like, she doesn't really get involved in things, she doesn't take sides, she's just omnipotent, nice thought, but not going to happen. And then guess what happens? They're in their middle of the diary, and all of a sudden all the animals come along, and Awa hears his prayer. So it'll be interesting to see if you have a physical manifestation of Awa, how that plays into the decisions about what to do and how to get involved going forward. Visually, there are 1,001 different things that you can do with this, so I'm not really worried about that. I mean, whatever it'll be amazing in 3D, and it'll look great on IMAX. I'm all in. Let's go. Let's. I'm down to do this again in 2 years.
Yeah, bring it on. And I think, we'll have a better determination of what we're going to go any further after the third one.
Indeed. So I am a good friend and I am a good podcast partner. Therefore, I will grant Chad Metz a Christmas gift by giving him a reprieve from talking about the Todd Phillips led DCEU. and we will reconvene tomorrow night at the same time if possible and talk about that. So he has the full 24 hours grace that I've given him. Merry Christmas, Chad.
I don't know if that's really a good gift or not, but thanks.
Gives you more time to put pen to paper and actually come up with thoughts instead of just incoherently ranting.
I mean, yeah, but then just watch some, the world's going to burn tomorrow for them or something. You know how it goes with them.
Well, yeah, you know what my favorite thing about that is that it's exactly what every Warner Brothers admit at this point. It's, hey, Chris, you want to make a Justice League movie for us? We know you just did 3 Batman movies, but would you like to do a Justice League movie for us? Please, Chris, please. No, go away. I need highbrow movies. Zach, we want to put Batman and Superman on the screen at the exact same time. Do you think you would be interested in doing that after the Superman movie? Yeah, bro, cool. Sounds awesome. Fast forward 5 years. Shit, that didn't work. Todd, you made this really, really cool Joker movie that everybody loved and had, made Oscar news. Albuquerque is Oscar finally. How would you like to run the entire cinematic universe? No, bro. I'm good with just making my Joker movies and then doing my art house stuff. Thank you, Bill. Oh crap. James, you know that guy, Kevin Feige. You worked with him. You know how to do these kind of things. You know our characters very well. You want to run the entire cinematic universe? Sure. But I don't want any actors from the Snyderverse, and I'd like to reboot and start over from scratch, please. No problemo, bud. Here you go. Here are the keys.
You gave me a gift, so I'm just going to sit here and not say a word until tomorrow. Because I don't want to call them stupid tonight.
That is the exact 3-minute history of the Warner Brothers attempts to make a DC cinematic universe. But that'll about do it for this episode of the Movies on the Brain podcast. If you want to keep up with this podcast, I am at DCW Tiger Fan
I am at the Mets Theory.
And our producer is at Grant L. Fletcher, who we'd like to thank for our J.R. Ripic intro to our 300th episode. And so thank you for listening, and have a pleasant weekend. And just remember, if that big man is number 30 in the Women's Royal Rumble, I will legitimately lose my mind. Thank you very much. Have a pleasant weekend.
It's done that, dude.